Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Zero to Agile. I am your host, Phil Giupixi. In this episode, I sat down with Ted Neward, Jessica Kerr, and Glenn Block at the CodeMash conference in Sandusky, Ohio.
Thank you guys all for coming, and we'll just let you guys introduce yourselves. Ted, you want to start?
My name is Ted Neward. I'm an architectural consultant with Neudesic, and I spend a lot of time in the .NET and Java worlds, and I'm a big geek.
Thanks. Jess?
I'm Jessica Kerr. I've been a Java developer for 8 years and a coder for 12. This is my first experience at CodeMash, and I have to say, man, those are some good parties.
Great. Glenn?
What goes on at CodeMash stays at CodeMash.
My
name is Glenn Block. I work at Microsoft. I'm a program manager. I've done a lot of work in .NET and a lot of work around .NET open source, and recently you've been getting involved with Node.js. Just happy to be here, and I am not distinguished, so where's that third person?
So we were talking earlier, and Glenn, you had some stories or some experience with TDD back in your early days.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear that. I'm sure our listeners would too.
Okay, so I started doing test-driven development in 2003. I was working for a company, a small company, self-funded in the Bay Area, and things were not going well. I was on this, back in those days, frameworks were in vogue. Everybody was building a framework, and we were building a framework, and we were just having a hard time stabilizing the system. Things were changing all the time. Stuff was breaking all the time, and I had heard about TDD, like I heard a few people talk about it, and I was just like, whatever, bah humbug. And I picked up Jim Newkirk, I believe, his book. It was a great book, like The Art of Unit Testing, or the name may be wrong. And I read the book, and the whole idea of writing tests to kind of stabilize my code made a lot of sense. The idea of writing tests first seemed extremely foreign, and like, this can't possibly work, and how am I going to get stuff done, and my life is just going to collapse. But I was thinking about it, and I was like getting like almost like hot flashes thinking about I need to try this, like I need to see, and then I can at least try it and it won't work, and then I can just say, okay, I tried it, I can just put it out and forget about it. And so what I did was we were working on an ORM. This is back in the days when Hibernate was just being developed. And we built our, everybody was building their own ORM, so we felt we should join.
There you go. Welcome to Vietnam. That's all I can say.
And I hadn't read your article yet. So we went to build our own ORM, and we had this massively complicated concurrency system that we wanted to have, my boss wanted to have, which would allow, like, when an entity got updated, it would automatically compare against the in-memory version and the version that was in the database and the original version that you had when you first got it, and it would magically determine whether or not the differential should be, could automatically be merged or whatever. It's a crazy idea, but it had, like, all these complications to it. I said, you know what? This is good. I'll take this piece, and I'm just going to try to write it in a TDD fashion. So I started to think about all the different test cases. Now, I wasn't really into factoring my code that well in those days, because I was just really getting into that. So I had one method that I ended up, like, when I started to think about this one method, which was going to be, like, this compare or whatever, was going to end up having 18 unit tests. Because I started to think about all the different use cases that I needed to validate against. Now, if I was going to write that code now, it wouldn't have been one method. There wasn't necessarily good separation of concerns there. But here's the part where I got convinced. So I wrote out the tests empty, and then I started to fill them out and write the code the way I wanted to write it. And I started to watch, like, as I started to, initially everything was red, and I was doing the red-green refactoring thing, and then I would, like, fix it, and I'd be like, you know what? Wow, I'm actually getting an idea. Not only am I seeing that the system is working, but I'm getting an idea of how close I am to being done with this particular task. So it was like a living requirements document, which I thought was pretty cool. And I could see, I'm halfway done. Half of my tests are finished. I'll try to make this shorter. So I have a tendency to...
No, you're doing fine. The only thing I do want to say is I don't know that we define TDD. So for those who might be new to that, that's test-driven development.
No, that's TED-driven development. That's when you hire me to do all your development.
Or test-driven design, depending on how you decide to interpret it.
That's true.
We call it playing the game at my company. Red-green refactor. Red-green refactor. Very comforting.
Well, we didn't even define what red-green refactor was, which I used.
Go ahead.
So red-green refactor basically means that, well, first off, TDD is really about me starting off writing just the tests. I write the tests that describe how the system should function, and then I'm going to flesh out the implementation to make those tests pass. And, you know, one of the problems we have, which Agile always tries to prevent, is this gold plating thing. So when I really identify the test, that means that I'm just writing only the code necessary to make that test pass, and then I move on to the next test. So I don't get into this like, oh, well, if I did this, then I could support all these other use cases. I don't think like that. I just stay very focused on the tests at hand and making sure they pass.
So really making sure you're following YAGNI.
YAGNI, right.
You ain't going to need it.
Exactly. YAGNI and gold plating are pretty close. So what was the convincing point was this. When I finished it all, or when I thought I was done, I went to go to check in. I had just made a last minute change, and I said, you know, I better just run the test before I check in. And something broke. And that was like a defining moment for me, because it was right before I checked in. We didn't even have CI yet. This was Glenn running the tests on his machine. But the fact that I caught something, and I pondered it, and I said, you know, if I wouldn't have caught that, that would have gone into the system. This was a weird edge case, but it was one that we wanted this to support, which meant it probably wouldn't have gotten caught for a very long time, and that just would have been a much greater cost to have. It probably wouldn't have gotten caught until at some point QA played with this and figured it out, and maybe they never would have hit it because maybe my spec wasn't clear enough and they didn't even think to write a test case
to evaluate it. This is the general thing I found with unit testing in general, right? Forget test driven for just a second, just unit testing. And I've never been really religious about, you know, TDD versus tests after the fact, right? TAD, test after?
TED.
TED,
Test eventual development.
There you go, test eventual.
I haven't heard that before.
But I think he just made that up. Okay. I think this is Phil.
I think it should be a new term, though.
You know what?
Let's get talk about
man
it.
Law.
Have you heard of TED?
So
your picture.
There you go. The whole thing about unit testing. I mean, I remember particularly in the Java space when you know the whole test infected article came out and testing was first getting started. It was one of those things where people, you don't see the benefits of testing until you hit that exact situation. But all the costs are front-loaded, right? And this is particularly the case in TDD, right? Where you say, all right, I'm going to write the test before I even try to do the implementation and so forth. And that's a good way to force yourself to write the tests. Right. I like it from that perspective. But I still remember, you know, in terms of a lot of what you were describing was how you think about the APIs, how you avoid gold plating, et cetera. And I remember 10 years before, you know, unit testing and whatnot, sitting down and designing an API from the client perspective,
sure.
Right? How would I want this to work as a client? How I want this to interact with this? Which was not really test driven, but it still tended to create APIs that were actually reasonable to use.
That is totally one reason to use test-driven development, because when you start from using your class instead of writing your class, you do that. You get the API right.
But building off what he said, when I worked in the .NET framework, Christoph Svelina, who wrote the framework design guidelines, one great lesson he taught me was write the code the user wants to write.
Right.
Like even when we would be doing our design reviews and everything, it was like, if I thought there was some API that needed to be there, write it. And we just start from that and look like, is this the right experience? Does this even make sense? And you can save yourself a hell of a lot of time because you write that down and you look and you're like, you know what? That's just awful. Nobody's going to want to do that.
Right, right. When you try to use some of this stuff, ideas that, you know, certainly make sense from the implementation perspective, then when you look at it from, you know, how am I going to use this? What's the code going to look like? Let me write some just, you know, again, you could argue they're unit tests. You could argue they're just usage tests.
Sure.
What would client code look like for a variety of different scenarios? And that's when you get the good feeling of, oh, wow, this is actually going to be pretty easy, pretty clean, pretty clear and understandable versus, oh, dear Lord, I wrote this API and I don't even want to use it. You know, that's really when you want to start ripping it out and start you know, readjusting, rebuilding.
And I've always considered the test kind of a convenient side effect of test-driven development because it's, It's something, and the reason I say it that way is people feel, or people get convinced that TDD is all about testing.
Right.
Right? And it's not really about the test. It's exactly what you guys are saying. It's about driving.
Jim Newkirk used to say the problem with test-driven development is the word test.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the word test gets taken completely out of context.
And it's driving the API
right,
through a convenience method, which is a unit test, because that's what we have, especially in .NET world, right? Yeah. And then a side effect is, oh my gosh, I now have code coverage.
I have found, though, since I was playing, you know, for a while I got really into BDD, which is really, there's a whole bunch of debate, like, is it TDD? The types of BDD I do is unit tests, but they're unit tests that are very focused on a customer scenario and how the system's actually going to be used. And the one thing, once I started to do that, that was a bit addicting because you realize that, okay, when I write straight old unit tests, it doesn't say anything about whether or not this thing is actually useful and is even going to be used correctly in the system. It just says that I say when I call open, a file should open. Does that actually make any sense in the scheme of the business? I don't know, but yep, the test pass all day long, but the thing sucks.
Well, so to avoid
behavioral-driven development.
Yeah, thank you. Behavior-driven development. Yeah. All right.
That sounds like a way to raise children.
It could be.
Yeah.
That sounds like an unsuccessful one.
Yeah, quite possibly. You know, it's interesting because, you know, you touched on the idea, and Jim mentioned it, you know, the idea that the word there, test, is really the misnomer. Stu Holloway, developmental instructor for a number of years, now owns Relevance, very big in the Ruby and Clojure space. Stu actually, he's got a talk that he does at a couple of conferences, how to fail with 100% code coverage. Basically saying that unit tests, you know, just because you have code coverage, just because you have
security.
100% code coverage does not mean that your code is correct, which I think is an interesting insight. And I think that's something that a lot of shops come to realize the hard way. And I think it's something that kind of needs to be made a little bit more public. But the other thing is that, you know, you talk about using the unit tests as a convenient vehicle, right, for doing other things. Stu actually coined the phrase exploration tests, right? So you're now presented with a new API. Let's call it Node, or let's call it, you know, a C++, C#, Java library, and you've never used it before. Okay, so what do you want to do? Well, if it's a database, first thing you want to do is open the connection, right? So let me write a little test that opens the connection, and now I have to test whether or not the connection is open. So now I need to find the way in the API to test whether or not the connection is open, and then I have to figure out how to close the connection and make sure it's closed. You just learn something. Now you do a little bit more work. You say, all right, we're gonna actually put something into the database, and then we're going to try to, you know, make sure that works. Now
you're saying all of, just so I understand you correctly, you're saying all of these are separate tests. First, I want to test to see, can I open it? Then I want to test to see if I can.
Well, see, this is the thing, is the exploration test, it doesn't have the same principles that a unit test does. Sure. I'm not trying. I'm going to assume that their library is, in fact, unit tested, that it does work. But what I want to do ultimately is I want to have a series of things that do little bits, probably a little bit more than you would ask in a unit test.
Okay.
So I'm going to write something to the database and then try to read it back, maybe change it and then write it back. And that might all be one test.
Right. And it's more of like an integration test. I'm not trying to stub out anything.
Right.
So I really want to find
out
how
this thing
works.
I'm not trying to mock anything. Because the whole goal here is to get at.
Yes.
I want to understand the API. I assume the API works.
Right.
I want to get at how I use it from the client
side. And I don't want to have to build an app around it like we used to do.
Bingo.
To see that the thing works, like I invested in.
And plus, one other thing real quick, Phil. Plus, when they upgrade this library, I will know whether or not it's still 100% backwards compatible, which to me was the brilliant part of this. Because how many times don't we actually do, you know, if 3.0 to 3.1, it should be just fine, stuff breaks. You know what? As soon as we get to the point where we suspect it might be the library, go pull out those exploration tests. They're not part of your standard test suite. Go pull them out, run it against the API, and go, oh, look, they broke something.
It's almost like a form of acceptance test for something that you didn't create.
Sure.
Like, you got a third-party library, and you just want to continually make sure that that third-party library functions the way you think it does. And if they make a change, you don't have to wait to read through the release notes. You'll know that the parts of their library that you depend on no longer work the way you think they do.
Well, and I think that's the key way of saying it, the way you think it works, right? You should assume that something you're buying works.
Right.
But do you understand how it works? And I think those exploration tests,
it's a great idea,
you know, prove out that you understand how it works, not just that it works, right?
I mean, and I find I do it, but not necessarily in as disciplined of a way as you say. Like, if I just want to play with something, if I can at all, like, unless it's like a user control, I'm probably not going to write a unit test for that. I'll just write some code.
Right.
But if it's anything that is non-UI based, like calling a website, whatever it is, running it through unit tests is just the easiest way to do it.
In many ways,
I just
ways,
need a DLL,
yeah.
create some unit tests, run it through the runner. I don't have to, like, build some harness or something like
right.
that to do
right,
it.
Right.
But I like what you're saying, which is more of a, like, organizations could embrace this and actually say, this is how we know that, like, some of these libraries may change and we don't have to find out about it later because we forgot to read the documentation.
Right.
We find out about it up front.
Right, right, right.
And I think that actually ties back into something you said earlier, Glenn, that your tests were like a living requirements document. Mm-hmm. And that's almost kind of what the exploration tests are doing as well. Not that you're writing the requirements and then solving them.
It's our system's requirements of this library.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your usage of that.
Yeah. I you know, one of the things, though, this starts to touch on something that bothers me a little bit, which is to say I've heard a bunch of developers kind of argue that, you know, we don't need documentation, just go read the tests. And it's like, you know, no.
We don't need code comments either because the code is the documentation.
Yeah. I mean,
I used to tout that as well, but I still.
Yeah, well, I mean, Corey Haynes was here at CodeMash, and several years ago, a bunch of us were on a bus down to DevLink, and it blew a tire, and we broke down in front of a Waffle House. And Corey and I got into this. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was a screaming match. I mean, you know, we were shouting at one another, and we had like a group of people around us from the bus, like stacked three deep. I expected them to start shouting, "Fight! Fight! Fight! Fight!" Anytime. On exactly that subject, can code be self-documenting, and if it's not, we should refactor, and yada yada yada. But the notion that the tests are your documentation, right. that the tests, because understanding the implementation is one thing. Yeah, we can go look at the source code, right? That's a separate subject,
sure.
which is worthy of its own debate.
Sure, I see.
But the idea of how do I interact with the API,
yes.
right? Do I need to write MSDN, C#,
right.
whatever style comments as to what this thing will do. Oh, no, just go read the unit tests that come with it, because everything comes with unit tests, right?
I've heard that complaint about Groovy, that the documentation is unit tests.
Right.
And some of my friends refuse to use it.
A lot of folks, I've heard it over and over again in the Agile community, yep. Even now, internally at Microsoft.
Yeah, and I the unit tests will demonstrate to me that the one drawback to testing in general is that they are always limited by the imagination of the guy writing the tests.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, this gets into some of the discussions around dynamic languages. You know, we don't need no static typing anymore. Well, yeah, except when you look at the compiler, when you look at the checks that it runs,
it runs
as
you write its unit tests.
Well, it runs the first suite of unit tests that I never have to write myself.
Yes.
And therefore it frees me to think about higher order things, higher level things, as opposed to, and I'm going to pick on Ruby just because it's the most popular one. When I get into Ruby, I have to test in some cases that this, you know, this thing returned and this thing returned, if they try to get added together or, you know, munged together, that in fact it yields the appropriate
do
error.
Do people actually write those? I haven't done enough like development in dynamic languages, and now I am with Node and stuff.
Right.
But do you find that those tests actually happen? Do they actually mimic the tests that the compiler does, or do they just not do them?
Well,
and they haven't really tested their system as well as they.
It's debatable. I mean, this is one of the things that the Ruby community is fighting in some cases. The guys who wrote Twitter, right? Originally, theirs was a Rails front end, and then they used Scala in the back end, which is an object functional language, very similar to F# over in the Java space. And one of the things that one of the principal engineers at Twitter was saying is that, look, if you write enough dynamic language code, if you write enough tests, you basically end up building your own type system. You basically end up building all of the infrastructure and all of the hooks and all of the checks that a modern type system would provide you.
So you're writing your own compiler.
It, to a certain
kind
degree,
of, yeah.
Right. And the Ruby community just exploded. They went ballistic over this. They thought, nah, lots of argument from very prominent Rubyists, right? Neil Ford, ThoughtWorker, meme wrangler over at or I already said ThoughtWorks. You know, he in particular took great umbrage with this to say, look, if you're doing it right, you don't have to do all that. But then in the next breath, he says, but what people do have to understand about Ruby, right? If you're a .NET or if you're a Java or if you're a C++er and you're looking at Ruby and you're hearing all these arguments about productivity and Ruby, blah, blah, blah. He says, look, at the end of the day, Ruby only will net you. After you finish writing all the tests, he's found Ruby is only about 10% more productive than doing it like a C# or Java or whatnot. Because he says, look,
all the amount of work you have to do.
You're going to have to write those tests. You're going to have to write those tests to have any sort of confidence in your code. Do you have to go so far as to create the type system, the compiler, et cetera? Probably not. But this is one of the things that I do like. I mean, at no point do I ever want to come across as offering up the opinion that we can all go back to just shipping code without unit tests. Yeah, hell no. There is, not even in the functional space where they have extraordinarily strong static typing, can we get away with shipping code without unit tests. And the functional community is really starting to come to embrace that as well, I think. But, you know, if the functional guys with their ridiculously strong static type system can't do it, then certainly the C#, Java, C++ of the world can't. And having said that, I like the compiler because it does a lot of that structure, does a lot of that testing. I don't want to have to deal thinking about things like, you know, short ints, long ints, big ints, and transposing between them and conversion rules. And
if you went to Gary Bernhardt's lightning talk, you saw some awesome of the iniquities you have to deal with, like combining two empty arrays gives you an empty string. And
that was JavaScript, to be
that
fair.
That was Ruby, that one, I thought, wasn't it? No, that one was JavaScript.
That one was JavaScript.
Did you know that Telerik Team Pulse also includes bug tracking and supports a complete process of creating, triaging, and assigning bugs? This bug management workflow allows team members to address bugs more efficiently and spend less time dealing with reported issues. Additionally, thanks to the tight integration between Team Pulse and Telerik Test Studio, you can capture bugs in the software you are testing and automatically log them into Team Pulse where they can be integrated into the development process. The integration also allows you to link acceptance criteria for user stories in Team Pulse to functional tests in Test Studio. For more information, visit www.telerik.com/teampulse.
Okay. Well, and you know, Crockford does the right thing, I think, with his book, JavaScript, The Good Parts, mm-hmm. where he says, look, at the end of the day, just, you know, for example, because of Ruby's, not Ruby, see, damn it, now you're getting me in trouble with the Ruby community. Because of JavaScript's Glenn Block, get out of my mind! Because of JavaScript's incredibly promiscuous conversion rules, right, those kinds of things can happen. So there are cases where you can compare the literal zero equals equals the string zero, and it's true. You're like, what? How the, what? What? Because it takes the string and turns it to an int and then says, oh, look, zero, zero. Or there's some cases where it's false. You know, where you're looking at something, you're like, you know, what?
That's exactly what Gary was talking about. He was demonstrating things that make you go, what?
Yeah, exactly. And
that's what
and
I called it, what?
That's what I heard. I wasn't there.
It's great.
And you know, languages that surprise you in that sense are generally not great languages to use. I mean, I think a large number of people are coming to embrace JavaScript mostly because it's there, not because it's the world's greatest language. I like JavaScript, ECMAScript, as it should be more formal.
Well, there's a lot of people embracing CoffeeScript.
Yes,
so it's helping them to not have to deal with a lot of that other stuff. But it raises its other issues.
Giving props to one of your coworkers where it's due, Eric Meyer called this whole JavaScript as the virtual machine for the web like 4 years ago.
Yep.
Right? What was it? Volta or Tesla or one of those research projects?
Volta.
Yeah, he called it. And I did not believe him, but you have some smart people working for you over there.
So Eric gets a raise.
Ted, a comment you said that I hear a lot because I do a lot of talks on TDD and BDD as well, was if you're doing it right, you don't need the tests.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just if you wouldn't mind giving me some of your thoughts about that, right? Because I hear a lot of times people say, I write, you know, my code doesn't break. You know,
I will say
and my shit don't stink either.
I will say, though, that once you start doing tests, driven stuff, this is my experience at least, it actually does change you over time to where the value that the tests, there's a certain level of value that tests provide you around design and stuff, that after a while you don't really need the tests to get that. You
the
do
test
learn it.
Development teaches you a new way to
exactly.
think. And once
and
you,
you
know
do learn
that way
that.
To think.
Like when I write code, even if I don't write tests, I start thinking, oh, there's a dependency, I need to factor that out. Whereas when I was first doing TDD, it was like, oh, it popped in my head because I couldn't write the test. Whereas now I'll just catch it up mm-hmm. front. So I think there's that. But the regression side of things, I think that's BS. Because you go and change a system. I mean, I like Bob Brumfield, the guy, program manager. I mean, he's a dev lead, actually. Sorry, Bob. In Patterns and Practices, used to describe, like, when you, if you're not using tests, it's like jumping out of a plane without a parachute, right? Because reality of it is, something will change somewhere. And by having good tests, you can even do radical changes. As long as your tests are the right ones, going back to what Ted said,
and
because
Neil,
you can see that once, because you can see that all the things that you thought the system was going to do, it still does in the new refactored state.
Yeah, Neil Ford has an example exactly like that when he was at ThoughtWorks, and I'll bet Jim knows the project too because it's an old story where they had this was a number of years ago. It was a Java system, and literally the night before this multi-million-dollar project rollout. The chief architect on the project, who's a thought worker, says, you know what? And he made some deep fundamental change. I mean, it was like, you know, he decided we were going to...
It's not minor.
It's not like, you know, we're just going to change the number of connections in a connection pool. It was something that required some significant refactoring in one particular module. This is the night before the big rollout of this thing that had to ship on this day. And you know what? They had a huge suite of unit tests behind it. And this was the thing that Neil used to do in these talks around testing. He would basically challenge the entire room. How many of you would feel comfortable reaching in and completely changing, like, the web page template engine that you're using the night before the rollout? And, of course, everybody in the room starts laughing because that's just ludicrous. He says, we did that.
I became convinced when I worked for a startup, they were like an extreme programming type shop. And like every week sometimes, they would make radical changes. Like on Wednesday, they would sit down and say, all right, this is the change we're doing. And it would be so severe. But because they had all the tests, that's what got me convinced. Because I didn't hit that as much. And then the other thing, though, that I really appreciated was, you know, like sometimes, you like before ReSharper, right, you could like rename stuff and rename things accidentally and just break stuff all over the place.
Or just test. Code, right?
there's
okay.
A subtlety.
Or Code Rush.
Might as well name them all.
Or good refactoring tools. Or Visual Studio now.
Studio, right?
So before,
oh,
we can just cut
God.
This whole thing. So I just got myself. Before good refactoring tools existed, this was a big problem.
Right.
There's a subtlety here, though. You talk about you have tests that are making sure the functionality of the system hasn't changed. A lot of times, and you spoke to this earlier, Ted, people will write unit tests that give them the code coverage, but if all you're testing is those individual methods, you miss the way they fit together.
True.
Are they fitting together correctly? And you need higher level tests that are testing the system.
Like the acceptance tests, integration tests.
And detailed ones.
Well, I have a great example of that because we went down to Legoland, which just opened in Orlando, and went down there with my family, and they have a water ride, and they had a huge submarine made out of Legos, right? And they had the guy standing, you know, the hatch was open, top of the submarine, and the guy standing in there looking through the periscope. Well, the periscope was outside the submarine. So to use the periscope, you had to open the hatch. Well, the whole reason you have a periscope on a submarine is so you can be under the water to look through it. Now, I'm pretty sure the unit test for the periscope passed. I'm pretty sure the unit test for the hatch passed. But when they put it all together, it didn't quite work out.
Oopsies.
Right? So.
Yeah.
Which is a great example of what Jess was talking about.
Well, one of the things, too, and I don't know if this is still a big deal anymore, but I remember a couple of years ago, the debates, the arguments that were raging over to what the size of a unit test would be, and if doing something that was a little bit higher level, a little bit more integrated, so is that still considered a unit test? And I mean, there just seemed to be this real push to try to put some kind of scope and put the notion of a unit test around in the container. And I just remember thinking, what a ridiculous argument, right? I mean, if you want to write a test, you want to write something that's automated, that exercises the entire Oracle database. Go for it, right? It's obviously not testing individual functionality from within the implementation of the Oracle database, but just, you know, go ahead, test the whole thing. Test opening connection, closing connection, doing this, doing that, et cetera, if that's what you need to test at. I really kind of believe in this sort of fractal view of tests.
Exactly. No, I agree.
Exactly.
Right? And you want to peg which area you're at, but I don't want to unit test the file system APIs on the operating system if I just want to test that MongoDB works.
Right.
Right?
But you don't want to wrap your getters, write unit tests for all your getters and setters just to up your code coverage either.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
there's a happy medium in here somewhere that varies with every piece of system you're working on.
Yeah.
Well, and code coverage is a whole other can of worms, right? It's like if you don't have it, it can be an indication that something's wrong. If you do have it,
then people
it doesn't mean your system is actually safe.
Right, right.
Well, because you can have 100% code coverage and not have a single assertion. Right? But I had a developer on a project who did that.
Yeah.
Right? Because he wanted to get his numbers up. He didn't have any asserts in his test, but he exercised the code.
Always the danger of a metric.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, one of the things about BDD, or behavior-driven development or design, is a lot of the folks doing BDD are taking more of an outside-in approach versus an inside-out.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the test-driven
development scenario, design, the whole thing of driving through the scenario.
I think you kind of started talking about that, and we derailed as this group will at times.
As Ted predicted.
Yeah. But that's okay. But I think that solves some of the problems, right, of the submarine with the periscope on the outside, right, Absolutely. As opposed to looking at the feature. I need this feature.
It also addresses a major weakness of developers. Developers get too far down in the trenches and too detail-focused, and when they think about how should this system work, they're immediately thinking about the low-level details, the database structure. Yeah. The behavior-driven development is going to force them to look at the system from a higher level.
I mean, I think it's really interesting, too, the explosion of interest there was around BDD and how people were pushing the boundaries of the language. And, you know, I'm still not 100% sure how I feel about it, though I've tried different tools like MSpec, for example, that, you know, use Lambda expressions to bend the language and how it does. And I know some people like Howard loves that. And I like MSpec, but I'm still not sure how I feel about it, but... And there's that vector, and then there's the vector of, like, should the business analysts or the requirements person be writing the actual tests, like the whole cucumber model you know, features and these files, versus, well, I listen to what he says and I write it in code, and, I mean, I'd be interested to know your perception on that. Like,
I mean, on the one hand, the idea of putting tools into users' hands that they can use to directly influence, modify, adjust, whatever, to directly do their job, I'm a fan. And the idea of giving the users tools so that the programmers don't have to be in the middle, that every time we want to change something, we don't have to go to the developers for a change. You know, so for example, you look at Amazon, you look at some of the business rules about who gets shipping for free and who gets Super Saver coupon points and all that stuff. Some of those kinds of business rules are really great to pull out of code that's written in C#, Java, Ruby, whatever, and put that into something like a rules engine or a scripting language, something like that. And the idea of giving them that power and saying, here, you can make those changes yourself. You don't have to involve engineering. You don't have to go through, you know, a 3-month period, 3, 6, 9 month change request, and we've got to make it go through QA. I mean, giving them that power directly, I think, is genuinely a good thing. Mm-hmm. But then we come back around to the other side, which says, okay, if I give them that power and they have power there, can I put a business rule in, for example, that if they write the rule wrong, gives everybody their products for free? I mean, that's clearly not a good thing. Right? And one of the reasons why we took the engineering parts of software and took it away from the users and put it in the hands of professionals, and people on the podcast can't see me do the air quotes, right? But you know, put it in the hands of IT professionals who supposedly have the discipline to find bugs and so forth. I mean, there's a real balancing act that goes on here.
But Glenn, were you talking about writing tests versus writing.
Well, the test is
what I was saying. I was basically saying, like, when you look at like behavioral driven development, there's all these different styles, and there's like the cucumber. You know, there's the somebody actually writes a text file like a business analyst that describes how the system should function, and then developers match against that, and they use like regexes and things. But it's where they've actually written the feature definition, so to speak, and that is going to become the thing that gets executed, technically. And then there's people that do things like with MSpec. It's like the business analyst is not going to write that.
Right.
Developers are going to sit there and they're going to write their own code. And then there's also developers that don't get to sit with an analyst, but they're still using BDD practices, kind of a hybrid thing. But it's like, okay, I'm building something that I believe is should work like this, but I want to make sure that I keep my eyes on the on the big picture.
Right.
So I'm going to use a BDD style to get me there.
Yes, this is the thing.
What I was kind of talking about, these different approaches. Thanks. And does that make sense?
The drawback here, right, of asking the analysts or asking the power users, asking the business to write those things, is it requires a degree of engineering thinking. In many cases, you really have to start thinking in sort of Boolean logical terms. You have to start thinking in terms of how computers and systems work. You have to start thinking in terms. And if you do this for too long, all of a sudden you kind of walk up to a programming language, go, oh, that's not really all that different from what I'm doing over here in this text file. If you try to let them write it the way they express it out loud, number one, a lot of times there are assumptions that they don't even realize they're making.
Yeah.
Within that, and just having them type it out into a text file isn't necessarily going to uncover those assumptions. Many times it will.
Well, that's why Jim, I know Newkirk, didn't like that approach, because he said, why should I force a business analyst to learn my language?
Right.
And express things like in a given when then style, when that's not how they think.
Right.
So I think what the important thing to do, regardless of the tool, is to make sure that you maintain the user voice through the whole process. And I think that's what MSpec is trying to do with the way, because I love MSpec.
I like MSpec too. Right? I can use stuff but still be questioning like every day, does this really the way to
Glenn has yet to find religion is what we're hearing here. Right? He's trying them all out, but he hasn't yet chosen a God.
Well, but something I think the fact that you are, you know, still questioning everything, I think that's a good thing. I think developers need to do more of that instead of just saying, this is the way I've always done it, I'm going to continue to do it this way, which was part of the subject of your keynote, Ted.
Yeah. Be cynical.
The biggest problem that I've always seen and why I think things like Cucumber and MSpec and those have popped up is it's the telephone game when you come to requirements, right? You got somebody way upstream says something, and I do this with my Cub Scouts all the time, right? I'll give them a phrase like the quick brown fox jumped over a log, and I'll tell it to one Cub Scout, and by the time it gets to the 12th Cub Scout, it's, can I have some cookies? Right? And they think that's what was said at the beginning.
Yeah.
And how many times have, you know, software fails mostly not because it doesn't compile,
right?
It fails because it doesn't satisfy the need.
Yeah.
Most bugs are wrong.
And that's why the idea of getting business people closer to the software is a good idea, because
sure,
it reduces the chain, reduces the opportunities for those operator-like disconnects. But the closer we bring them to the machine, the closer you get to the machine, the more you have to think the way the machine thinks. And this, I mean, there's a clear tension here.
What if it's done together? So I heard of a really interesting use case. So Jimmy Nielsen,
right,
and I were hanging out, and he was talking about, he runs this company called Factor 10, and is it Factor 10? Yes, it is. And he's done this great book on domain-driven design and stuff, and we were hanging out, and we were talking about BDD. He's actually a big fan of BDD. And he was saying how they actually use it with their customers. And what they do is the developer sits with, and they write it together. So it's teasing out, like, we're talking about stuff. They don't have to talk in given when then. They'll say what they're feeling, but they'll be sitting together so he can validate and confirm.
Right.
But it may get into a feature file, and then they're also learning the syntax at the same time.
So what we're doing, what they're doing is making
like
sure
pairing up.
Well, it's making the feedback loop as rapid as possible, right?
Yeah.
It's not going through a design review and this, that, and the other. It's their pairing.
Yeah.
Right? And the feedback loop is, you know, I want the site to do this. The developer types in something. Did you say you want the site to do this? And he's like, no, I meant that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
and shortening the feedback loop, which is, again, from
the developer. Domain-driven design has the same aspects. Right. If you read Eric's book, and he talks about the same process they go through.
And that would be Eric Evans' book,
Domain-Driven Design. But which is another buzzword. Sorry, we're full of buzzwords here.
That's okay. I'm trying to keep up. I'm new at hosting the podcast thing, so I missed a couple.
At the end of the website.
Yeah, I missed CI.
We won't mention CQRS.
So for those...
Ow! Ow!
Wow.
Dang.
Yet another.
Yeah, there you go. Let's just go through buzzword bingo here and see who wins by the end of it. You know, one of the things, though, that you know, when Dave Thomas first started talking about Rails, right, that was like the big draw. That was the big thing, right? You could sit down with your customer, and you could bang out the website with them sitting right there. Right? That was the big productivity thing. That was the big productivity win, particularly when compared against its predecessor, which was, you know, I somehow storyboarded, I draw pictures, I hand it off to the developers and to the web designer, and maybe 6 months later I get to see what this thing is supposed to look like. And even if you, I mean, the big drawback to your customer pairing with you is your customer has to be there to pair with you.
And willing.
Willing to suffer through the miscommunications, willing to suffer through the pauses, because in some cases they're going to want things, at least it's been my experience, where the customer is going to say, I want the system to do blah. And it's like, okay, cool, that's going to be a couple of hours before I can really show you that. And so now they're going to sit there while you do this?
No, I don't think they're pairing with code.
He's
right?
Not, it's yeah, pairing, they're pairing just the to specs. Write the feature files.
Write the specs.
So you've combined two of the core components of Agile, which is testing and shortening the feedback loop.
Right.
Yeah, he's not writing the code. It's just they're sitting together and
I originally saw them writing the code, and that was like, okay, this is not going to scale.
No, they're
this
writing the feature
work.
Files.
Yeah.
They're writing the feature files.
Jessica's my new
co-host. It was just
the
about the feature files, which for those that don't know, if you look at Cucumber, it's like a text file that actually describes how the system is.
Right, so it's not actually showing the code, but making sure that what the developer is writing down as a specification matches what the user said.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
So you're getting the user as close to the machine as possible without removing the
you
developer.
You still have an interpreter.
From the loop. Exactly.
Right, the developer is now your interpreter.
Exactly.
It's the
They're
compiler.
Not going to look at code.
So we're the compilers, right? They're the code, and we compile it and turn it into a spec. To
and,
be
and
truly
that gets
geeky
to,
about it.
I mean, the problem with DSLs is people ask users to write code in them, basically. But you get 80% of the value from the DSL when the user can read it. And that's exactly what's happening and what Glenn's talking about. Glenn can write it. The customer can read it right there and provide feedback.
But the question is, I mean, and when I think about it as we talk about it, like when Jimmy first told me, I was like, wow, they really do that. He's like, yes. Then I started to think about it and say, well, I mean, like what you said, like, is it better for him to go off and write some spec in his own language, and then I don't understand it, so I got to like go back and forth, and you know, use Word's great reviewing feature if I'm using Word, and you know that works great for the first iteration.
But yeah, track changes like, and comments and all that stuff. Yeah,
then it becomes like the devil.
Yeah. By the way, go back to the Word team and have them put version control into the damn thing already, would you please?
But I mean, and it's also very iterative, right? Because it just means like, hey, we take this small chunk. Now we're done with that. Let's move on to the next one. Let's move on.
Part of the thing is, one of the things that I've seen, the whole Agile movement, to me, really just gets summed up around this whole notion of rapid feedback, mm-hmm. right? Shorter feedback cycles. Doing whatever you need to do in order to be able to see what I just did and make sure that's what was supposed to happen. And that, you know, the interesting thing to me is that one of the shortest feedback cycles is a compiled language. If I write code that won't run, the compiler tells me immediately as opposed to waiting for the unit tests to execute. And then we go to the second order, which is the unit tests, and then we go to the third. You know, this is where Agile is saying, hey, we should really have the site up and running very quickly. Let's do a quick iteration, show it to the user, they get to play with it. You know, on projects that I've been on where I've had the ability to influence this, I've always wanted to have the QA server, the QA site, the internal place that we're deploying the code
staging.
That's not the daily build, staging, whatever. I always wanted to make that available to the user community, right? To the internal project champion and his related folks. so that they can start playing with it. They can start banging
on it.
Well,
one process, too, is like after each iteration doing like demos, too, to show the progress.
See, I don't like demos because demos imply that there is, you know, there's kind of a rah-rah factor behind demos. When you say we're getting ready to do a demo in front of the customer, A, it implies that I'm driving, not them. I don't want to be driving because implicitly, as someone who is, in fact, proud of his work, wants to receive, I'm going
to
go down the happy path. I'm going to say, look, this is the new feature we did for you. Hey, rah, 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 let's all pop champagne. I don't want that if I'm looking for feedback.
Right.
What I want them to do is to break it.
Right, because the user will say, what if you click on that button? Oh, don't click on that button. Don't do that.
I want you to click on that.
That's for next week's demo.
I want them to click on the button and have it blow up.
That's a great
idea. As part of that, we also get to set, you know, when the bugs occur in production, how are we going to know about it in development? So clicking on that button, if it does nothing, should trigger an email. It should trigger a note. It should trigger a something that says something blew up, right? You know, feature not implemented exception. And that should get filtered. That, in my book, that goes straight to the bug tracking system. And then from there, we can triage it out because we knew that that wasn't implemented yet. But now that infrastructure is already in place for when it goes into production and somebody does something and it should have worked and it doesn't, we already have the mechanism that gets it back to the developer so the user doesn't even have to say, oh, what happened, you know, fill out the bug report. What happened? It broke.
Well, and one thing that we did, I had a particular customer who the QA manager wouldn't allow us to deploy anything to integration or the certification server until they went through their reviews and things like that. So we couldn't, at the end of every sprint, deploy it anywhere that a customer could see it. So we built VPC or virtual PC images of the software because we had BizTalk, Evolve, WeCommerce, we had several things. And then we shipped hard drives to key users, internal users, and so all you have to do is plug it in and start it up, and you can play with it. And we were able to get that feedback.
Yeah, because that feedback is critical.
Oh, it's absolutely.
I mean, you know, at every level, right? You want feedback in your code. You want feedback from your users. You want feedback even on the process itself, right? That's the thing that Agile is really stressed. That's the thing that Lean and Scrum and Kanban really kind of seem to be focusing on is, you know, let's have some feedback on the process itself. At least that's what I've seen a lot of the good Agile coaches doing,
right,
is saying, you know, how well is this working?
Well, as usually happens when Ted, Glenn, Jessica, and I get together, we talked for hours. So if it sounds like we're a little cut off, it is because we are. So stay tuned for the next episode where we continue the discussion.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you for listening. If you have any comments, concerns, or suggestions, you can reach out to us at telerik.com/zerotoagile, follow us on Twitter at zerotoagile, or send us an email at zerotoagile@telerik.com. See you next time. Thank you.